America behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I am Ben, and today we are still hosting Car Stuff, don't worry. We're going to talk about hazardous materials, or hazmats.
Correct-a-mundo.
Yes. Now, it's okay to be correct. That's not in itself hazardous. But we came up with this idea, because we have those moments, everybody has those moments, where you're driving and you see that very distinctive diamond-shaped sign. And if you're a fan of, you know, disaster movies and things like that, then you already know. I'm sure you already have elaborate disaster scenarios in your head.
The liquid nitrogen truck overturns, everybody freezes and breaks into a million pieces.
Yeah, yeah. How's and then that? Cue action. That was really good.
Yeah, I know. I'm always a little paranoid about that one.
Really, for me, it's log trucks.
Oh, you know what?
But they're not even hazardous.
No, yes, they are. My neighbor in Indiana, when I lived in Indiana, my next door neighbor's mother was killed by a log truck. The load shifted on a curvy road, and I think it was in Kentucky or Tennessee.
Oh no!
And crushed the car that she was in. So they are hazardous in their own way, but not hazardous material. So to speak, like where you have to call in a team of experts to remove said material from the road.
Right. That's
Sorry, man. Yeah, I see your downturned face. It didn't mean to take it in the wrong direction.
Well, you're not making anyone else with an irrational fear of log trucks feel any better.
You know what? I'm actually kind of worried about those when I see them as well, just mainly because of that story. But they look so precariously placed on there. Right.
We know that the people driving those and the people loading those are professionals.
Oh, sure. I'm the same way about round sewer pipes. You know, those big concrete pipes, but the ones that are round specifically.
Because you know they can roll.
I know that they're easy to roll off of there. So, just a worry I have.
So to add to some of your fears – no, I'm kidding. Actually, to what we'd like to do with this episode is to sort of explain what hazardous materials are – how they're transported, just a little look at the substances behind those diamond signs.
Yeah, and they mean something. There's something very specific. There's a system in place, I guess, that everybody adheres to, so that that diamond that you see, it's the same for every company, but they have to adjust it according to the load that they carry. And do you want to kind of go over this the system that they use, or how do you want to break into this, Ben?
Sure, why don't you do the system? Well, let's start with a definition of hazardous materials.
Sure, go right ahead.
This is from the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. The definition of hazardous materials are those designated by the Secretary of the DOT, Department of Transportation, as, quote, posing an unreasonable threat to the public and the environment, end quote. So,
boring.
I know.
And here's the thing. Yeah. It can explode, or it can suddenly chemically change into something that would really, really hurt you. Corrosive material.
Poisonous.
Yeah. That's more exciting, Ben.
They're not. You're
snake
right.
Snake venom on wheels.
You're right. I love that definition, though, because if you cut it down to layman's terms, what it's basically saying is hazardous material is what the Secretary of the DOT says it is.
This stuff's going to blow up.
Yeah. There are nine classes that go in there. Those include explosives, gases, flammable liquid, flammable solids, oxidizers, organic peroxides, poisonous or infectious substances, radioactive material, of course, corrosives, and then class nine is miscellaneous dangerous goods.
Fantastic.
So why don't we go ahead and talk about the colors or
the sign itself, because the diamond that we're talking about is on the back of trucks, is on the side. It's well marked on most vehicles. Well, it has to be well marked on every vehicle that carries hazardous materials, or it should be anyways, if they're adhering to the DOT standards. There's a red square, I guess, or diamond, another diamond. These are diamonds within diamonds, I guess.
Yes.
Four diamonds within the big diamond. There's red at the top, blue on the left, yellow on the right, and then a white one at the bottom. And the blue one means the health hazard of the material that's being carried, either zero through four, rather. Mm-hmm. Four being deadly, 3 is extreme danger, 2 is hazardous, 1 is slightly hazardous, and 0 is normal material, which I don't know what that means. Mm-hmm. Normal is always a weird word to use.
Yeah.
I don't know, normal material, but 0. Then the red one is fire hazard, or the flashpoint of the material being carried, and that goes from, again, 0 to 4. Number 4 is below 73 degrees Fahrenheit, which that's a little scary.
Yeah, that's incredibly
keep that really
flammable.
Cool. Yeah, exactly. And number 3 below 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 2 below 200, 1 above 200, and then 0 is will not burn. So 0 is the safest in that case. Mm-hmm. The yellow diamond is instability of the substance. Now this one this is really scary. Goes again from 4 to 0. Number 4 may detonate. Number 3, shock and heat may detonate. So that's like, what, mm-hmm. nitroglycerin, I guess.
Sure.
Number 2, violent chemical change. That sounds bad. Number 1, unstable if heated. Not so bad. And then 0 is stable. So, mm-hmm. again, 0 are the ones you want to see on this truck in front of you, I guess.
Right.
Then the white one is what? Specific hazard.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes from – these have letters to designate what they are, or a symbol for radiation hazard.
Right.
It can be an oxidizer, acid, alkali, corrosive, or some, you know, a mark that tells you don't put any water on this. So if there's a fire on the truck, don't throw any water on top of this thing. What would that be, like magnesium maybe? Something
yeah,
like that?
Maybe something like that. Use any chemical that would basically require you in a disaster to use a different sort of flame suppressant.
Sure, yeah, like they do at airport runways and things. That they foam things down instead of just spraying water directly on the mm-hmm. fire. Could be like a grease fire, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Where that only makes matters worse.
And then also on those signs are those little placards there. There are 4 digits, and these 4-digit numbers, excuse me, these will be on the sides of the trucks and the cars, railway cars. This is another kind of sign. They refer to specific chemicals or group of chemicals that are actually signed by the United Nations or the U.S. Department of Transportation to describe these chemicals or these what classification these fit into.
Mm-hmm.
There are too many really for us to go into in too much depth. Freudian slip.
Yeah,
there,
what are you thinking about?
I'm student loans.
Think of the bills.
Yeah. But you can check the Department of Transportation's emergency response guidebook to figure out what each of those individual numbers means.
Okay, very good. So, you know, what all these do is they help emergency vehicles or mm-hmm. first responders or just even people that, you know, need to know this type of thing, like the people patrolling the highway to make sure that, you know, the correct materials are being hauled on the roads.
Because right.
there are certain roads that restrict flammable or explosive cargo. Mm-hmm. They have bypasses for those vehicles. I'm sure that anything with a radiation risk has, you know, special designations mm-hmm. of what roads they can and cannot travel, maybe even times a day that they can travel. I've heard of this before in the past that
yeah, I can see that.
You know, they shoot for times when there's very little traffic on the road.
Don't take your depleted uranium through the Boston rush hour.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah, they may designate, sure, you can do it, but do it at 3 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something like that. I don't know if it's even possible, but there are certain rules in place to make sure that, you know, the drivers adhere to that or the companies adhere to that.
And
Go ahead.
Okay. Yep. Well, there are the laws that we've looked at here are designed to, let's see, what's the best way to say this? Well, let's go with what our buddies at the Fed level say. These are really just a list of classifications, as you said, Scott, for first responders, but also to ensure the proper packing and shipping precautions are met.
Oh, okay. So you're not putting, like you said, uranium in some beat up old pickup truck and hauling that through town.
Yeah, just toss it in the back.
No. There's certain ways to carry certain materials, right?
Right. And for the this is a sweet deal for the normal driver. You know, you're just in your daily driving car
mm-hmm.
because this is a series of laws that is designed entirely to make you safe. And you don't really have to do anything if you are a little bit nervous about the way somebody's driving with hazardous material. Then really you can get out of the way. But thanks to this law, you'll know what they have. And learning to read these signs is relatively simple. But let's talk about who has to do the work dictated in these laws. They – three of the big people we have to know, or three of the big roles, are what are called the employer, the employee, and the offerer. Now, an offerer for us, we would just probably call that a shipper, the person actually shipping the goods. The employer is, of course, someone who uses, or a company who uses their employees in connection with transporting hazmats, getting them prepared to transport, or is basically any way associated with anything that's in any way associated with transportation of hazardous materials. And there's a question here, like, why does the chain of responsibility extend that far? And it's quite simply because the potential for disaster, regardless how small, is still definitely there, especially if we're talking about, you know, something that's a yellow diamond at rated 4. That's our may detonate.
Yeah, that would just be a bad one.
Just might blow up.
Yeah, I would think so. So you need drivers that are licensed to haul said material, mm-hmm. that know the dangers involved with this material,
right.
And know what to do in certain situations to avoid, let's say, detonation.
Yes.
And very important, I would think. Yeah. So, you know, we laugh about it, but I mean, these rules come down from, you know, from above. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason for every one of them. You know, I know some of them may seem kind of crazy, but or over the top. But again, it's to protect the people that are all around the vehicle on the road, and the people, of course, driving the vehicle, and the place where they're shipping to and from.
Right.
It's all about safety, really.
Yeah, and as a result, there are registration requirements, mm-hmm. for anybody who's going to be affiliated with the transportation of a hazmat or hazmats. They need to. Let's see, you have to register in advance. You have to receive training within – I think the way the law goes now is you have to receive training within 90 days if you're not currently qualified. Every 3 years you have to requalify, or whenever there's a change. There are some – in the laws, there are some exceptions. If you are an agency of the federal government – I'm sorry, you work for – an agency of the federal government, a state agency, or a political they phrase it a political subdivision of the state. If you're already a hazmat employee, if you're living outside the U.S. and you offer hazardous material solely from outside the U.S., that may be an issue of jurisdiction. But, you know, registration, you have to do it every year. And it does include a fee.
So you get a safety permit, really. You get a safety permit from the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, which is the FMCSA.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you have that permit, you need to register with something called a PHMSA, which is the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. And that allows you then to, go through this, or at least begin carrying, this hazardous material, whatever mm-hmm. it may be. I mean, and we're talking about, a lot of different things, right? I mean, explosives, it's liquid nitrogen, it's liquid oxygen,
sure.
it's fuel, it's oil, mm-hmm. Milk.
Now, you've mentioned that. Let's sidebar this. Break this down for
me. Yeah, sure.
What's going on?
Now, this is kind of weird because raw milk is considered a hazardous material.
Because it hasn't been pasteurized?
This
maybe?
Is raw milk, I guess. And I don't know if it's – I didn't find out if it was specifically raw milk or if it's also pasteurized. Because what it has to do with it is the way that the EPA and the Department of Transportation want to classify milk as oil. There's oil in the milk. But what it comes from is it's fats and oils of animal origin is how the EPA and the DOT see it, right?
Yeah.
So milk having oil is – and I'm not a chemist or anything, but of course.
All right.
But apparently there's oil in there, and that is – so if you have a large-scale spill, let's say on a highway, mm-hmm. The danger is, of course, bacteria. You know, you need to find a way to wash this down. It's not just a matter of diluting it.
Right.
Because of these oils, I guess they have to contain the spill and remove the material. Other thing is that if there's water nearby, I guess it can contaminate water easily. And I never thought about milk and water, not mixing all that well because mm-hmm. of the oil within milk. But there is an environmental hazard with it. And I know it sounds really silly, for a milk spill. It kind of is in a way. I don't see a huge, huge risk with spilled milk.
Well, you can't cry about it. We know that. But now it seems like it's nothing to laugh at either. Huh?
I was really waiting for it. I knew it was going to come up somehow.
Oh man, I'm too predictable now. Yeah. But, that's a really interesting case because you mentioned this to me before, we went on the air, and it's baffling, but it is, again, it's sort of an illustration of a better safe than sorry situation.
Sure. And a lot of times the reason for transporting these materials, now they could be used in manufacturing. You know, they could be taking, you know, a material from one location to another. It could be from the source to the place where it's going to be used in production of some kind.
Right.
Or it could be waste. And in the case of waste, they take it to certain toxic landfills, you know, dumps. Mm-hmm. Some of these are called Superfund sites. Have you ever heard of Superfund sites?
Yes.
Not fun.
Yes. Superfund.
Fund. F-U-N-D.
Like Superfund. Fundamental.
And if you do a search, you can find Superfund sites in your own area. Also Superfund sites, I guess. But if you search just do a Google search for ToxMap, T-O-X-M-A-P, and you should be able to find a map that shows either Superfund sites or toxic sites in your area. And what they are is these sites that the EPA, they find the responsible – this is where they house all of this material that the government is taking care of, really, I guess.
Right,
The EPA finds a responsible party. And this is what a Superfund is, really.
Yeah.
The EPA is responsible to find the responsible party for the spill or the mess that has to be cleaned up. And if they can, you know, they make the person pay for the cleanup and, you know, where the material goes to, whatever the costs are associated with that.
Right.
If they can't find the responsible party or if the party doesn't exist, they do, of course, but if they, you know, it's a natural disaster or something like that, the EPA pays to clean it up using a special fund, which, you know, they have designated as the super fund. And it's stuff that's – I mean some of it's literally buried, you know, just to keep it out of – out, you know, from air contamination.
Mm-hmm.
It's really kind of an interesting story if you dig into super fund sites and what they contain.
Which is frankly a disturbing amount of waste.
It is an awful disturbing amount of waste. Read the read the Radioactive Boy Scout if you want to get an idea of what may be contained at a Superfund site. That's there's a shed buried in some desert somewhere, thanks to that. But it's an interesting story, and it'll give you an idea of what they may take care of and how they clean up.
And let's also, just to catch folks up about the Radioactive Boy Scout, this is, correct me if I'm wrong, Scott, this is the story of the person who, as a Boy Scout, managed to scrape enough of that glowing material off of watches.
Correct, yeah.
And
smoke detectors, chips from smoke detectors, and he built a fusion reactor or a fission reactor?
Fission.
Fission reactor in his parents' shed in his backyard.
And then he got in trouble,
Busted. Yeah. Got busted with it, riding around with it in his car.
But he went back and repeated this a couple times, right?
That's right, yeah. There's some updates to the story, but, the real interesting part of it is the history of it, you know, where it all started in his parents' backyard. So it's called, again, the Radioactive Boy Scout. Just check it out. It's a quick read and, definitely interesting.
And Scott, let's tell these folks some things that will hopefully make you feel a little more secure on the road when you're driving around a hazmat vehicle.
Sure, as you should.
Yeah. The carriers are responsible for several things there. Of course, they need to have – their employees have to receive, you know, function-specific training. They have to have safety training, and they also have to have what's called security awareness training. Now, these – as we said, these are kind of a these sorts of training recur every 3 years with the initial training and anytime there's a change in job function. But there's also a great emergency response system set in place where they've got an emergency response telephone number and it has to be monitored at all times while, you know, the waste is being hauled.
Oh, I see. So it's a continuous monitoring from point to point.
To me, that's tremendously reassuring.
Yes.
It's not like, can you imagine being stuck in some, let's just go worst case scenario. There's a radiation hazard. It's gone crazy. You see the overturned tanker and then you see that little diamond and you think, oh man. And you call the emergency number and it goes, Thank you. Your call. Thank you for your time. Your call is very important to us. Please stay on the line and someone will be with you.
Oh my gosh.
Press would be, one for health hazard.
That would be terribly frustrating, wouldn't it? But, like you're saying, you know, once they know something's gone wrong at that point. And, you know, if I was a driver, I think I would carry my own set of hacksaws, a hammer to break the window out. I would carry, the jaws of life to cut my way out, whatever it took to get away from that vehicle.
And you should just not just you in specific, but we all as drivers, should carry, I'm a big fan of those little hammers that can break a glass window.
Are you?
Yeah, I think I think that they have potential to be very useful.
Really? Okay, very good.
I hope that I'll never be in a situation where I have to break a window to get out.
Are you talking about like escaping, well, I guess any case, but maybe like in a lake or something?
Sure, like a sinking car, you know, or maybe the door is crushed up and inoperable.
You're well prepared, Ben.
You know what? I don't know how well prepared I am. I think I could always be have more preparation, but no way, man. Are you kidding? I don't want to have to. I don't know if a hammer is necessary for everybody because I will bust that bad boy out with my elbow.
Ah, come on.
With my
try
head,
it.
If it
you
comes
know what, try
to it,
it. Try it today. Let's see what happens.
No, I got to have my endorphins
you'd
going,
have a,
dude.
You have a sling the next day, I think. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. I got you.
If I have my endorphins going.
Sure. Yeah,
sure.
You could lift your car.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
We should do a podcast.
Tear the door off, like Henry Ford.
Then I would be my own hazardous material.
Yeah, that's right. Right?
But that's basically what we want to do with this podcast, right? Is just break down what it is, what those signs mean.
Exactly. And I hope you got some understanding of the system because there is a system in place, this classification system. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you should be reassured that, you know, these things are being monitored and carefully checked. They're not quite as dangerous as you may think they are on the road.
And before we head off into the sunset here, I've got a little listener mail if you're interested.
I am.
Okay, Scott. So Rob writes in to us from Georgia, our home state over here, and he says, "Hey guys, as a certifiable gearhead, your podcast is one of my favorites. Your recent episode about driver's education really got my attention because I own a driving school in Georgia." Now, he says that he goes on to say that he has a couple description or a couple corrections for our description of Joshua's Law as it applies to teen drivers. His school specializes in teaching Joshua Law classes. He said it bugged him a little to hear some misinformation. It's a Georgia-only law, and it went into effect in 07 as a result of a fatal single-vehicle accident of Joshua Brown. So his parents began a teen driving safety advocacy program resulting in Joshua's Law. The law requires anybody who wishes to get their Class D driver's license when they're 16 must complete a Georgia Department of Driver Services training program. An important distinction is that the program is not mandatory. If you don't want to take it, you just have to wait till you're 17 to get a Class D license. And so he breaks down. It's a 30-hour class taught by a state-certified instructor, completed student driver workbook, 40 hours of supervised driving with a parent or guardian, and you have to do at least 6 of those hours at night. And then there are some options that you can take a 6-hour behind-the-wheel training course with a training school, and completing that course eliminates the need to complete the driver handbook, but you still have to do that 40 hours of supervised driving, which I think is a great idea.
Oh, I think it's a very good idea. So we thought it was a national law. It's a state law. Mm-hmm. And also we weren't clear on, I thought it was mandatory as well. I thought, that everybody had to complete that, but, you're saying that if you wait until you're 17, you're beyond that age.
For this law, which is, again, only in Georgia.
And, okay. Good info.
Let's see. He writes on with some more information. We won't go into it now, but
it was a long email.
It was a long email. It was very in depth, and really appreciated the feedback there. So, Rob, thanks so much for writing in. And I got to tell everybody, you guys, I do really enjoy when we have the opportunity to get feedback and to bring it back to our listeners on the air. But man, guys, I screwed up on this one because I read Rob's email and I wrote back and I said, "Those are really good points. Thank you." And I must have had my auto text on or something, because I wrote back and thanked him for more information on Jacob's Law and not Joshua's Law.
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
But Rob, thanks for being a trooper. He even wrote back and said, you know which one it is, right? Sorry for the typo.
You're thinking of Jacob's Ladder.
I am thinking of Jacob's Ladder.
Sure.
Which is its own podcast entirely.
Sure.
But so we're going to go ahead and head out there. Scott, I don't know. What do you think, man? Should we ask people for any hazmat stories?
Oh, why not? I mean, I guess – well, that'd be pretty interesting really to find out if anybody's been involved in a situation where the hazmat team has had to been – you know, have been called out, or you've seen the hazmat team in action. Because those guys do just great service. I mean, that's a difficult job. I don't envy them at all, especially in those hazmat suits in the summertime.
Oh gosh, yeah,
gotta be difficult. Gotta be really hot in there.
Well, they're.
But yeah, anybody that's got any kind of hazmat firsthand experience, I'd like to hear from them.
Yes, and you can tell us about it on our Facebook or on our Twitter. You can also check out our information. We've got an article about hazardous materials on the website. And if you'd like to tell us your story directly, please do send us an email at
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.